No, the bloody Russians have pulled out of the war.
Well, we soon saw them off, didn't we, sir? Miserable, slant-eyed, sausage-eating swine.
The Russians are on our side.
Are they?
And they've abandoned the Eastern Front.
And they've overthrown Nicholas II, who used to be bizarre.
Who used to be the Tsar, boy.
In the last episode, we were introduced to the Bolshevik sailor Ilyin, alias Raskolnikov. Raskolnikov had a habit of being present when history took place, like some kind of Bolshevik Forrest Gump. On a sunny day in early June 1918, he received a telephone call from Lenin. Raskolnikov hurried to the Kremlin, where he met Lenin in a well-lit office, lined with bookcases and a map of Russia. "I sent for you because things are going badly at Novorossiysk," said Lenin. "The plan to scuttle the Black Sea fleet is meeting with a lot of resistance from a section of the crews and from all the White Guard-minded officers. It is necessary at all costs to scuttle the fleet, otherwise it will fall into the hands of the Germans." Their conversation would have been unthinkable and incomprehensible to themselves just 2 or 3 months earlier. To destroy their own fleet would have seemed like madness. But things had changed radically in a short time. You're listening to Revolution Under Siege, a podcast from the 1919 Review. This is a podcast about the Russian Civil War, that revolutionary conflagration that engulfed 1/6 of the surface of the Earth. Today's episode is number 4, Cossack Revolt in the South. To get the text version of this podcast, look up 1919review.wordpress.com. Raskolnikov recalls, "Vladimir Ilyich got to his feet and, sticking both his thumbs under the armpits of his waistcoat, went up to the map on the wall. I followed him. 'You must leave today for Novorossiysk,' Lenin continued. 'Be certain to take with you a couple of carriages manned by sailors with a machine gun. Between Koslov and Tsaritsyn, there is a dangerous situation. The Don Cossacks have cut the railway line. They've taken Alexeyevo.'" You will recall that barely 6 weeks before, Lenin had declared the civil war over. Now here he was in his office, talking about the Don Cossacks in revolt again. "And on the Volga," he added, "there's a regular Vendée. I know the Volga countryside well. There are some tough kulaks there." Lenin had just referred to the two fronts that had opened up in May 1918, the South and the East, the Don and the Volga. Next week we're going to look at the Eastern Front, that Vendée revolt on the Volga. This week we're going to look at the South, where the Cossacks and the Volunteer Army had risen from the ashes. Raskolnikov set out from Kazan station that evening. The sunshine had given way to rain, and the station smelled of wet clothes and cheap tobacco. The fresh evening air contended with the fumes from the locomotive. Next morning he awoke on a carriage, rolling through the war zone of South Russia. It was a struggle of horses and railways, and the front lines shifted every day. Rumours of battles agitated him at every stop. There were delays. At the next station he might find a battle raging, or whites ready to shoot him. And every hour's delay might result in the Black Sea Fleet being handed over to the Germans. How had this situation come about? The Bolsheviks had come to power promising to end the war. That meant signing a treaty with Germany. But the German and Austrian governments had demanded the most humiliating concessions. In the first few months of 1918, debates had raged both within the Bolshevik Party and between the various parties of the Soviet over whether to accept these terms. Finally, the German government forced the point by going on the offensive. There were battles all along the front line, but the Red Guards were no match for the advancing German forces. The only way to stop them was to accept even worse terms. The Soviet government signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk on March 3rd, which, in essence, ceded the Baltic states, Poland, and Ukraine to the German Empire, handing over not just its territory, but the possibility of revolution in the short term in these lands. It was a gamble based entirely on the hope that a workers' revolution in Germany would come soon and render the treaty null and void.
Trotsky himself, as foreign minister, soon came to Brest-Litovsk to conduct the negotiations. Finding the German terms intolerable and believing Germany on the verge of revolution, he declared the war at an end but walked out, refusing to sign the peace. The only walkout of its kind in history. Immense anti-war demonstrations in Germany followed, as Trotsky had hoped. But the demonstrators were shot down. The Kaiser was still firmly in power. Guided by his generals, Hindenburg and Ludendorff, he renewed the advance against Russia. A majority of Lenin's Central Committee wanted to fight, but Lenin insisted on signing the peace and by sheer force of will, personality, and cold reason compelled it. His resolution and composure could not be daunted by a little thing like a treaty of peace. But the whole world was against the Soviets. On a pretext of supporting the independence of the Ukraine, the German soldiers marched into Kiev and clear across Russia to Rostov on the Don.
The strength of the German armies, combined with the weakness of the fledgling Red Army, meant that the Germans might seize any pretext to grab more territory, even to crush the revolution. The situation was so serious that Lenin had a contingency plan for the Soviet government to abandon the big cities and hold out in the Ural Mountains and the Kuznets Basin, which is yet another measure of how little he expected revolt in the East, but we'll get to that in the next episode. In a sense, the war continued. 3 months after the signing of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, the peace was being violated by all parties, without matters yet escalating to all-out war. Now the German government was demanding that Russia's Black Sea fleet be handed over to them. They were in a position to seize it anyway. Moscow was determined to defy this order and sink the fleet instead. They had already given up so much in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, they were not going to give up the Black Sea fleet, which might then be used against them. But the sailors and officers were refusing to carry out this command. That's where our friend Raskolnikov came into the picture. Raskolnikov made it through the war-torn Don and Kuban lands in one piece. Along the way, he passed through Ekaterinodar, where Kornilov had been killed 2 months earlier. Now the city was under siege once again. He arrived at the port of Novorossiysk at long last, taking in the view of the sunlit harbour, full of destroyers and dreadnoughts. On the decks and on the shore, a fierce debate was raging over whether to obey Moscow's order or to defy it. Raskolnikov addressed a group of sailors. In order that the fleet may not fall into the hands of German imperialism and may not become a weapon of counter-revolution, we must scuttle it today. A young sailor demanded, "But why can't we put up a fight, seeing that we have such splendid ships and such long-range guns?" The young sailor knew well that such a fight would mean certain death. This did not deter him. As well as those who wanted to go out in a blaze of glory, there was a hidden agenda, especially among the officers. Many of them wanted to hand the fleet over to the Germans, in the hope that it would then be used against the Bolsheviks. But after long debates, Raskolnikov convinced the sailors to destroy their own fleet. It was a bitter victory. If you've ever wondered what it looks like when a massive warship is blown up and sunk, you're about to find out. Here is Raskolnikov's description of the death of a dreadnought named Free Russia. When the smoke dispersed, the vessel was unrecognizable. The thick armor covering her sides had been torn off, and huge holes with twisted leaves of iron and steel gaped like lacerated wounds. The ship slowly heeled over to starboard. Then she began to turn upside down with a deafening clang and roar. The steam launches and lifeboats fell, smashed, rolled across the deck, and like so many nutshells, dropped off the high ship's side into the water. The heavy round turrets with their 3 12-inch guns broke from the deck and slid, making a frightful din across the smooth wooden planking, sweeping away everything in their path, and at last, with a deafening splash, fell into the sea, throwing up a gigantic column of water like a waterspout. In a few moments, the ship had turned right over. Lifting in the air her ugly keel, all covered with green slime, seaweed, and mussels, she still floated for another half hour on the grey-green water like a dead whale. The oblong, misshapen, floating object shrank in size and at last, with a gurgling and a bubbling, was hidden beneath the waves, dragging with it into the deep, great clouds of foam and forming a deep, engulfing crater amid a violently seething whirlpool. The Russian Revolution had secured peace, at a terrible price. The dreadnought Free Russia was the least of it. In this and in future posts, we're going to see the consequences playing out. The Don Cossack Revolt. We saw in part 2 how many of the Cossacks went over to the Reds. Ataman Kalyadin shot himself, 18,000 Red Guards held Yekaterinodar, killed General Kornilov, and threw the volunteer army back out onto the steppe. For a few weeks, there were Soviet governments on both the Don and the Kuban, the lands of the two biggest Cossack hosts. The Don Soviet Republic had a president named Podtelkov, who was both a Cossack and a member of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. But under the surface, things were changing. Most Cossacks never warmed to the Soviet government. They saw it as a government of the aliens, the outsiders, their poor despised tenants. They saw it as a government of the mujiks and kokols, insulting terms respectively for peasants and Ukrainians. And again, my customary apology for not being able to pronounce Slavic names correctly. The former frontline soldiers who had supported the Reds now settled back into village and family life, and many of them fell back under the influence of their elders. In April, the German forces advanced through Ukraine. The Red Guards made a stand in the Donbass region. In a moment that was later celebrated in paintings and novels, Kliment Voroshilov led the courageous defence of a bridge, allowing many to escape capture or death. The survivors fled east on a long march to Tsaritsyn on the Volga. The Don Cossacks must have watched these events with keen interest. The Donbass was in German hands, and its Red Guards were out of the picture. So this was a big change to the situation. Another big change to the situation was that thousands of ill-disciplined and armed soldiers wearing red armbands were now streaming across Don Cossack lands. Some looted, killed real or perceived enemies, some assaulted women. Down in the Kuban region, there was a similar crisis with soldiers returning from the Turkish front. The same Cossacks who had shunned Kalyadin earlier in the year now took up arms against these intruders. On May 8th, the Germans took Rostov on Don. 2 days earlier, right-wing Don Cossacks had already risen up and seized Novocherkassk.
Get down!
On May 11th, Podtelkov was captured on an expedition.
Where are you from, Cossacks? From the village of Tatarsky. You're a bit too late. We've caught Podtelkov without you. Where are they? There they are. Where are they taking them? To the other world. Stop lying. What do you think? The gallows are ready for them.
They hanged him and shot the 70 plus Cossacks who were with him.
O men, allow me and Krivoshlykov to watch our comrades die. hang us last. And now we'd like to look at our comrades and support the weak in spirit. Well, let them. Very well. Let them step back. Hold on. You still refuse to tell your name? Mean to die nameless? I have a name. I'm a member of the Russian Communist Party of Bolsheviks, a Petrograd worker of Cossack origin. Enough. At the betrayers of Cossacks, fire!
From there, the revolt snowballed. The victories of the Red Guards that we saw in episode 2 were undone at a stroke. In April, it had seemed that the civil war was over. But by mid-June, the Don Cossacks had seized a vast territory and mustered an army of 40,000 with 56 artillery pieces. The resistance of the Reds, meanwhile, was feeble. They were deprived of their base in the Donbass, they were distracted by the Volga revolt and the German threat and a million other things. The Volunteer Army. In earlier episodes, we saw how the Volunteer Army was formed in Cossack lands from officers who were determined to stop the revolution. It was a continuation of the Kornilov coup attempt. At the start of May 1918, the Volunteer Army was becalmed in the Kuban country to the south. In February, they had broken with the Don Cossacks and gone out on the ice march. In April, after suffering untold horrors, they had been defeated at Yekaterinodar. Now their leader, Kornilov, was dead and they were encircled in the wilderness. The German advance and the Don Cossack uprising changed the situation utterly. The Germans and the Cossacks now held all the north-south railways, forming a great wall, protecting the Volunteer Army from the revolutionary power that resided in Moscow. The volunteers at this point numbered just 9,000. The original 3,000 to 4,000 had been bolstered first by Kuban Cossacks, and second by General Drozdovsky and his troops, who had marched all the way from Romania. We have noted the extraordinary number of generals that were in this small army, but these generals were not afraid of combat or hardship, and accordingly they dropped like flies. Markov, Drozdovsky, Alexeyev, and of course Kornilov. General Anton Denikin, bald-headed, white-bearded, the author of the memoirs we quoted in episode 2, succeeded Kornilov as leader. To look at Denikin, you'd think he doesn't have the same wolf-like leanness and fierceness that you see in Kornilov. But in fact, he was a very effective leader, and the volunteers under him exploited the new situation created by the Don Cossack revolt. Although the Kuban was now cut off from Moscow, the Volunteer Army still faced an enemy numbering 80 to 100,000, 10 times their number, the two Red Armies of the Caucasus and the Taman Red Army. Denikin was outnumbered 10 to 1. But these early Red Armies were in fact loose coagulations of detachments, undisciplined, untrained, uncohesive. Their only link to Red territory was by the Caspian Sea. Later, when ice made the sea impassable, their lifeline was a long camel train through wilderness. They were connected to Moscow by a very long, thin line, via Astrakhan and then Tsaritsyn. They were an outpost of an outpost of an outpost. Bands of Terek Cossacks and guerrillas from Dagestan operated in their rear. Typhus raged in their ranks. And just across the Caucasus Mountains were the Turks, the British, the French, Menshevik Georgia, and the forces of various nationalist parties. And now the Kuban Cossacks rose up against the Soviet power and flooded into the Volunteer Army. Generals who had been commanding platoons soon had companies, regiments, and divisions under them once again. A wholesale massacre of outsiders, aliens, and Bolsheviks began. This massacre is recorded in the novel The Iron Flood by Alexander Serafimovich. The aliens were like survivors of a sudden apocalypse, stricken with terror at the pace and fury of the revolt, as seen in this account, which is reputedly an accurate account of the events it describes. Slavyanskaya village has revolted, and so too have Poltavskaya, Petrovskaya, and Stiblyavskaya villages. They have built gallows in the squares before the churches, and they hang everybody they can catch. Cadets have come to Slavyanskaya village, stabbing, shooting, hanging, drowning men in the Kuban. They've run amok. All of Kuban is in flames. They torture those of us who are in the army, hang us on trees. Some of our detachments are fighting their way through to Ekaterinodar, or to Rostov, but they are all hacked down by Cossack swords. Serafimovich, with the usual disarming frankness of these early Soviet writers, also records fully the terror that these same Red Guards had meted out on a much smaller scale to the officers prior to the revolt. The volunteer army grew to at least 35,000 by September. A long and brutal struggle began. The Reds were usually on the defensive and unable to bring their numbers to bear in any way. Still, they fought hard. The courage of these early Red formations was extraordinary. They fought for Soviet power even though it seemed that they were on a sinking ship. They were poor people, each revolting against a lifetime of humiliation and toil, fighting for a better world. They had gone too far now to go back. They had to fight on through or die. So Denikin's White Army, the Volunteer Army, turned out to be the most important White Army of all, especially in 1919. But for the rest of this series, Series 1 that is, dealing with the events of 1918, we're hardly going to talk about them at all. That is because the numbers and dogged resistance of the Reds bogged down the Volunteers and the Kuban Cossacks for the entire second half of 1918 and into the start of 1919. So the rest of Series 1 will deal with events from May to the end of 1918 in other parts of Russia. But the reader should bear in mind, or the listener indeed, that this struggle at the feet of the Caucasus Mountains was grinding on relentlessly in the distance. By the time this bitter struggle finally came to an end, most white units had suffered at least 50% casualties. One cavalry unit had suffered 100%. In a series of terrible battles, Denikin and his volunteers seized town after town. In August, they seized Ekaterinodar. What was left of the Red Kuban government fled to Pyatigorsk. In the autumn, Novorossiysk, the bed of its harbour still strewn with the corpses of dreadnoughts and destroyers, fell to the White Guards. In January-February 1919, a cavalry unit, the same one that had suffered 100% casualties over the course of the campaign, broke through the Red Lines. After that, the White forces overran the Caucasus pocket so quickly that many of them caught typhus from the Reds. Not a whole Red Army, but a whole Red Army group was destroyed. The two vast Caucasus armies and the smaller but brilliant Taman army, in all 100,000 to 150,000 soldiers. The Whites took 50,000 prisoners, 150 artillery pieces, 350 machine guns. Fewer than 1 in 10 of the Reds escaped. They crossed steppe and desert in winter, the Astrakhan on the Caspian Sea, where commissars traded recriminations over the catastrophe. But just to be clear, I've jumped ahead of the main narrative, so let's return to the summer of 1918. Denikin and the Kuban State. General Denikin had been campaigning for a military dictatorship ever since spring/summer of 1917. Now, probably to his great surprise, he found himself in charge of one. The volunteer army set up a militarized state in the Kuban Cossack lands, or maybe it was a military with a bit of a state hanging on to the edges. They were just to the south of the new Don Cossack Republic, though relations were not neighbourly. Denikin's politics were close to Kornilov's. After the Reds were defeated, he promised elections to a national assembly would be held and the military dictatorship would end. For Denikin, there could be no question of restoring power to the Constituent Assembly. It, quote, arose in the days of popular insanity, was half made up of anarchist elements, end quote. My impression is that Denikin and his officers would not have considered any election legitimate unless a knout-wielding Cossack glowered at the voters over every ballot box. Denikin did not like to admit that he was a reactionary. He had a distaste for the word. On occasion, he spoke of self-determination, but he spoke far more often of, quote, Russia one and indivisible.
We'll wait for you in order to enter the Kremlin together to the sounds of ceremonial marches and our anthem, and together experience the joy of peace and freedom. To the great, one, and indivisible Russia. Hooray!
The historian Jonathan Smeal makes the fair point that Denikin and Kolchak was another key white leader who will be introduced to later, were, quote, far from the cliched caricatures of pince-nez-adorned sadistic fops, end quote, of Red propaganda. Kolchak, Denikin, and Kornilov and Alexeyev, they were not aristocrats. In fact, Denikin's father had been born a serf. A few lines later, however, Smeal concedes that the camps of these generals were heavily populated with nobles and the wealthy, and many of them, in accordance with the values of Tsarist military discipline and aristocratic contempt, would absolutely have been sadistic fops wearing pince-nez. As stated in part one, a fifth of the volunteer army's personnel came from noble families. British officers who were invited to a great banquet in Denikin's territory were embarrassed when the orchestra began to play God Save the Tsar. The request had come from a member of the royal family who was present. The non-military sphere of Denikin's government was limited. War was, quote, not the right time for solving social problems. But it was dominated by members of the Constitutional Democrats, or Cadets, a party with a wealthy social support base. Perhaps Denikin was chosen as leader partly because of his humble background and a sympathetic, democratic face that he could show to the world. But as we saw in part two, he was as determined a counter-revolutionary as any officer in Russia. The volunteer army was composed of men for whom war was a vocation. They expressed this in an elaborate system of uniforms and badges. The colourful regiments were named after dead generals, and they wore distinctive uniforms. The Kornilovtsi, for example, wore black tunics with red caps and wore a shoulder badge with a skull, crossbones, and crossed swords. Veterans of the Ice March wore a badge with a crown of thorns on it. They loved their special badges and their colours and their outfits. For now, the reader only has to keep in mind that for the rest of 1918 and into the early part of the following year, Denikin and his army were engaged in a merciless and brutal struggle in the south that didn't really link up with the broader civil war, but which would have profound consequences in 1919. Kalyadin to Krasnov. Can a single individual change the course of history? In the years before the revolution, the socialists of Russia had meditated on just this question. The Role of the Individual in History, 1898, was a pamphlet written by George Plekhanov, a founder of Russian Marxism. This text argued that leaders and supposed great men were in fact mere conduits for the great impersonal forces of history. Lenin and Trotsky and others had looked up to Plekhanov, but by 1918, Plekhanov had long since broken with his past politics and was firmly on the right of the Menshevik Party. He cursed the Bolsheviks and the revolution as, quote, a revolting mixture of utopian idealists, imbeciles, traitors, and anarchist provocateurs. We must not only crush this vermin, but drown it in blood. If a rising does not come spontaneously, it must be provoked, end quote. Meanwhile, a Bolshevik artillery piece had proven the point that he had argued in his pamphlet 20 years before. The shell that killed Kornilov showed the limits of the role of the individual in history. the movement Kornilov led, survived in spite of his death. Produced another leader in the form of Denikin, who was just as capable, if not more so, and carried on from strength to strength. The same thing happened in the Don Cossack country. Kaledin had committed suicide in February, as we saw. By May, his supporters had returned to power, and they produced a new leader in the form of General Pyotr Krasnov. This Krasnov had tried to seize Petrograd in November 1917, but was defeated and captured. These were the magnanimous early days of the revolution, so he was not put up against a wall and shot, or even locked up. He was released on his word of honour that he would never again raise a hand against the Soviet power. July found Krasnov leading an army of 40,000 Don Cossacks against the Soviet power. So that didn't turn out well. Krasnov did not just break his word to the Reds. He betrayed the cause he had served during the World War. During the war against Germany, he had commanded a brigade, then a division, then a corps. I don't know how many lives he spent on the front lines in the struggle against the Kaiser. Now his Don Cossack Republic owed its very existence to the German army, received weapons and aid from it, and paid it back with loyalty. Krasnov even became pen pals with the Kaiser. Denikin remarked, "The Don host is a prostitute, selling herself off to whoever will pay." The Don Cossack officer Denisov retorted, "If the Don host is a prostitute, then the volunteer army is a pimp living off her earnings. Those posh officers could act all high and mighty all they wanted, but they owed their survival to the German intervention. The volunteer army got weapons from Germany via the Don Cossacks." The Cossacks knew that the volunteer army looked down on them, saw them as petty and provincial, as diminutive kazachki. For their part, Denisov spoke for the Don Cossacks when he called the volunteer army, quote, "traveling musicians." This obscure remark seems to mean that the volunteers were tramps, bums, not an army of the people, not rooted in the soil as the Cossacks were, but an army of the intelligentsia and upper classes. But for now, each of these forces was busy in its own backyard, and there was no cause for them to clash. While the volunteers were grinding the 100,000 Reds of the Caucasus to dust, the Don Cossacks were on the offensive, eastward to Tsaritsyn and northward to Voronezh. The Reds could only watch from a great distance, as the Red armies of the Caucasus went down fighting. On the Voronezh and Tsaritsyn fronts, they could only react, not take the initiative. They were distracted by the fighting on the Volga, by the German threat, and finally, by a revolt at the very heart of Soviet power. These events, respectively, will be the focus of the next two parts of this series. Listen on to find out more. Thanks very much for listening so far. Berbua, Slán.